Thanks for staying with us here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. Well, we had the spring equinox. It symbolizes the start of spring, and that's an occasion, I think it's celebrated around the world. We're going to talk about that and a whole lot more with our weather guys. One of them with me right now, Steve Ackerman. Steve's Vice Chancellor for Research and Graduate Education at UW-Madison. Also, of course, holds a professor level in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. John Martin is finishing up teaching a class right now, but he'll be rushing over and be with us along about noon. John, a professor in Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. So what's your local weather like? You need any help defining a weather term, perhaps, you heard on TV or on the radio? Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234, or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Steve Ackerman, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Yeah, it's great to be here again, Larry.
I tell you what, all of the weather forecasters I listened to over the weekend and coming into Saturday, and especially on Friday, people were saying, well, we're going to get some snow, but you probably won't have to shovel it.
Yeah, that was, I was one of those thinking, you know, it's going to be, you know, a couple of inches, big deal. And then it's going to warm up, which of course it did. But yeah, when I woke up, I had just over 10 inches at my house, the unofficial amount. Airport, I think, at like 12.1.
Yeah, I'm nearer the airport than you are, and I had a little over 12 inches of snow.
And it was heavy.
And it was heavy.
Yeah. And I got my snowblower out after it started to die down, and then tried to, you know, clear it, extra stuff with the snow shovel, and it was just like slush at the bottom.
Yeah, it was. But my new snowblower actually threw the snow, but then I had to shovel too because there's places you can't.
I'm thinking of a new snowblower after that.
But I'm telling you, I'm so happy I have a new one, but I still get a little sore from that wet. What was going on?
So
there?
You know, it really wasn't that bad of a forecast. I mean, right, if you're thinking of 1 to 4 inches and you wake up and it's almost a foot, that's not good in many ways. But the thing is that, you know, the challenge with doing snowfall predictions or forecasts is when does it occur and where does it occur? Right. And so even when we were going after the 1 to 4 inches, they were talking about, you know, Friday night into Saturday. And so that's, wait a minute, did I get that day right?
Or was it Saturday? Friday night into Saturday morning.
And that was right. And the biggest, heaviest precipitation was to fall south of us. And what happened was that whole location of that band of snowfall was further north than what the forecasts were. And that's why many of us were shocked when we looked at the morning and think, but I thought this was supposed to be a few inches, not a foot. So it wasn't so bad of a forecast, even though we will certainly remember it as being a busted forecast.
Well, what a time to come during the spring equinox.
Right.
Oh, man. So what is the spring equinox, by the way?
So the spring equinox occurs, we're coming out of winter. The axis of spin that the Earth is pointed at the North Star, so it's always fixed. And so as you imagine it going, or the Earth orbiting around the sun, sometimes it's pointed away from the sun, and that's our winter. And sometimes it's pointed towards the sun, and that's our summer in the Northern Hemisphere. And as it revolves around, you know, the sun, the where the sun intersects the latitude moves south to north and north to south. And so at the spring equinox, the way that I like to think of it is when the sun hits the equator and is heading from the southern hemisphere to the northern hemisphere. And so we hit that, and I think 4:38 or something was the day on the 21st when that was the time.
That was
And that's why they get so exact of when spring starts, because that's when it hits.
Everybody wants to know.
Everybody wants to know. And
exactly.
Then we get 10 inches or a foot of snow, and we wonder what happened to spring.
Exactly. Oh, my gosh. So, and they've been important. I mean, this goes back to ancient peoples, doesn't it? I mean, they were...
Yeah,
they found a lot of importance in tracking the sun. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, you know, and you think of Stonehenge. That's one area where it marks the path of the sun through the sky. There's also ones in South America as well, and in China. And if you think about it, during those early civilizations, I mean, agriculture was really important for as a food supply. And that was directly tied to the seasons, which is directly tied to where the location of the sun is. And so they marked one theory is they marked a lot of that associated with the time of year and the growing season and celebrations around that.
Adrian in Cable has a question for you. Let's go there. Mm-hmm. Hi, Adrian.
Hi. I was kind of curious, what is considered by NOAA to be like the average snow depth of an area? So I was out yesterday morning skiing near my home in the Chequamegon National Forest, and I was getting measurements of about 30 inches in the sedge meadows next to a stream, about 33 inches in the alder thickets under the fir trees. It was about 19 inches, and there's a few bare spots. Last week, I was getting as much as 40 inches in the bog near my home, and I just kind of was curious when NOAA, and I go on their website occasionally and see their snow depth measurements, and just kind of curious, what is considered the average snow depth of an area?
So the way that they measure snow depth is what they call a snowboard. So there's and I forget the dimensions of it, but it's a square board made out of wood that's suspended above the ground. And that becomes the official measurement of which they'll make the depth of the snowfalls. If they don't have a snowboard to make those official observations, then, yeah, they'll go around in an open area and make a couple of observations and then average that out.
They could come over to my home, and on the second floor bedroom area, I have a deck that goes out, and when I woke up and I looked out, I could tell there was a foot of snow from what was on the top of the deck rail.
Yeah, that, right. one of the reasons why I say mine is unofficial is because it's not an official measurement with the National Weather Service. But I do participate in volunteer areas to report snow depth and precipitation. And, yeah, what I use is our glass picnic table in the backyard. And so, you know, that's probably maybe 3 feet by 6 feet. So it's pretty broad, and it remains pretty flat. But even as the day goes on, I can see it starting to droop off the glass table. So I try and get it early. So that's how they make the measurements. That's the official way.
There you go, Adrian. Thank you for calling. Clint and Nina, we'll go to you. Hi, Clint.
Hi. I was calling, and conveniently you just talked about the official way to take measurements. I actually volunteer for COCORAS.
Yeah.
Community Collaborative Rain, Hail, and Snow Network.
Yeah.
And we use the official measurements in order to, or the official techniques in order to take our measurements here. Well, because I was in Nina during this particular storm, I was right at the center of where that heavy snow band set up. And we had, at one point between 7 and 8 a.m., we had 6.3 inches of snow accumulate.
Wow.
In an hour. No.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. So
you might have thought you were living in Buffalo, New York.
Right.
Wow. But anyway, go ahead. Sorry, yeah. Clint.
So I was actually calling, though, because that 6.3 inches sounds like a lot of snow. But if you were to squish it down to the water that it actually is, it would have only been about 2/10 of an inch of water. And so I was hoping that the guests could talk about the water equivalency in snow, because I think a lot of people don't understand. That's also why some of the forecasts are off at times, because it's hard to pin down what that water equivalency is going to be and how it's going to translate into snow depth.
Yeah, actually, that's a really good point. And, you know, to give people a sense, what I usually think of is when we get that fluffy snow, its conversion rate is like 10 to 1. And so, you know, in the situation that we had, you think of it, you know, it was a foot of snow roughly or so.
And
so
wet.
In terms of precipitation, yeah, it's less than an inch if you take that 10 to 1 ratio. So as a rough guide.
But with it wet snow like that, wouldn't there be more?
It would be.
Because it would be
heavier?
Yes,
that's right. It would be heavier, right. So it would be more more than 10 to 1.
There'd be more water.
Yeah. I should have looked at what the official water equivalent was. Because the way you do that, too, is you can take some of that and melt it down and then measure it in a rain gauge. And I use Kokoros, too, as well. But I don't do it in the wintertime because I take my rain gauge in. Yeah.
There you go, Glenn. Thank you so much for calling. Susan in Vilas County emailed and wondered if you could explain atmospheric rivers and how they differ from other weather systems, or if they actually do.
Yeah, they don't. It's a good name. It's a fancy name. And the way that we look at it or detect them is from a satellite. And so we have satellites that look at clouds. We also have wavelengths that we observe the Earth with that can measure water vapor amount. And one of those is, we call it the water vapor channel on the geostationaries, because that's what it measures. Not very creative, but
but it works. It
tells the story. And so what these atmospheric rivers are is long, narrow, well, they don't necessarily have to be narrow, but they're long streams of atmospheric water vapor. And they typically run from the way we typically use it, particularly with associated with precipitation on the West Coast, they can run from over by Hawaii all the way up to the West Coast of the U.S. So it's a long path. And as you can imagine, since we see it, we can watch and track their movement. And when those atmospheric rivers, when they carry a lot of water vapor, again, we can measure how much is in there. When they get to the West Coast and start going up the mountain ranges there, that provides lift, condensation, snowfall, or rainfall. And that's been what the problem is.
In California. Yeah, for
before
sure.
Before the term became popular, atmospheric rivers, we used to call them the Pineapple Express.
Remember that?
Yeah, because they would carry a lot of water vapor from Hawaii towards the West Coast and leads to a lot of precipitation.
We can talk some more about that, and we'll take Dean in Colorado's call in a little bit as well. We're going to take a quick look at the news, though. We'll find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Network, and then we'll be back with Steve Ackerman, Vice Chancellor for Research and Graduate Education at UW-Madison. You can join in, too, and join Dean, who will be waiting online. Number to call is 800-642-1234. Email to ideas@wpr.org. Stay with us. We'll be back right after this look at the news. Great to have you with us on the Ideas Network, taking a look at climate and weather with our weather guys back with us once again. John Martin joins us now. John, a professor and former chair of the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW. John, good to see you.
Good to see you, Larry. Glad to be here.
And Steve Ackerman, he and I have been talking for a while already. Steve, it's nice to have you as
about
well.
Snow.
Oh, yeah?
And John has a snow tie on right yeah. now.
We're a tenth of an inch away from the snowiest March ever in Madison. So,
really?
Is that
yeah.
right?
And we got a chance Wednesday and another chance Friday. But not big
What's
chances.
What's the record?
25.4, 1959, before Hawaii and Alaska were states,
wow.
I think.
Wow, that's interesting.
Wow.
Yeah.
Pretty amazing, huh?
That's amazing.
Well, that is really cool. And you may have a cool question for our guests, and I hope you join in. If you do, the number is 800-642-1234 or email to ideas@wpr.org. And let's go to Dean in Colorado with a comment. Dean, hi.
Hi. Yeah, good morning or good afternoon out your way. We're in Colorado. I just wanted to mention that we do a little bit different things with our snowboards out here, meaning snowboarding.
We were talking about measurements and snowboard.
We were talking about measurements.
This is a play, right? Good play on words.
That sounds like a dig from out west.
you had mentioned we – up here in the foothills get snow a good bit of the year, anywhere from September last year, I think early June, we had some snow here. And then we were well experienced with that water equivalent issue that was mentioned. We've had water equivalents closer to upper teens, close to 20.
Wow.
And then as low in the springtime, closer to 3 to 4 area.
Wow, yeah. So really variable based on how fluffy it is.
Yeah,
exactly. And then as you climb it with elevation, you see it in the same day. Lower elevations, much higher snow water equivalent than up in the higher elevations where we have champagne powder, they call it.
Mm.
Ah, right.
But yeah, very feathery, very fluffy, very, very low density in terms of water. But, you know, you guys had mentioned the discussion of bomb cyclone, and that was not a term that when I was an undergrad learning for meteorology, learning about bomb cyclones, that seems like a more popular maybe term for cyclogenesis.
Well, rapid cyclogenesis, yeah. And the term was first coined in the literature in 1980 by maybe 1979. Fred Sanders and John Jackham, who's at McGill now, thought about cyclones that develop rapidly and called them bombs. And only in the last, I'd say, 5 or 10 years, you're right, that it's been picked up by the media, I think maybe mostly by the Weather Channel. But that's a word that's been around for about 4 decades, but it hasn't really been in popular use very long. You're right.
And it's intensification. It's like
it's a rate of intensification.
Millibars per 24 hours.
24 millibars per 24 hours. Yeah,
that's just like 24% of the pressure in an atmosphere, which is a lot. Right,
that's a lot. You got it's a lot of rearrangement to do. Like if you go down to your basement, you're going to do 24 millibars of change equivalent. You're going to move everything out of your basement in a day. It's going to be that kind of work.
I don't have a basement.
Dean, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. And Rich in Middleton, still wondering about snow measurement, I think. Rich, hi.
Hi. I'm kind of perplexed, but I know there's an answer to this. I was hearing on the radio this morning on the TV news, and said, well, this winter we got 60 inches of snow in Madison. I said, wait a minute, that's 5 feet. I didn't see any 5 feet of snow.
Yeah, but you know, over the course of your working career, you make a lot of money, but you don't see it all at once. So, you know.
5 feet is a real stretch.
but you know, they use a snowboard out at the airport and they measure it, I think, every hour. And so they don't get to, you don't account much for settling, you don't account much for melting upon hitting the ground, all those things. But when you add it all up, that gives you the total amount of snow for the season. Each time it snowed, each measurement is kind of done on an hourly basis. So that's how you add it up. But you're right. I mean, it's sort of stunning to hear that we've had 60. I think actually Madison's on the order of 70 for the year. And that is exceptional. It doesn't seem like it's been that snowy a winter. It's been a snowy March, but not that snowy a winter, but it has been.
Yeah. That's because it warms up and it all melts, yeah,
and,
all melts
away. And we only had two events. This 12-inch, 12.1.
I thought we had three.
Maybe we had three that were in the 6-plus category, and that's relatively rare. In the 12 category is really rare. We haven't had one of them in more than 10 years. I think it's more like 15, actually.
Wow.
So that's very rare.
Yeah. Rich, again, thank you very much for that question and comment. Ralph and Eau Claire will give you a chance. Hi, Ralph.
Okay. I have a question about the Southern Hemisphere. Do they have a jet stream in the Southern Hemisphere? And in the Northern Hemisphere, our winds are from the west to the east. In the Southern Hemisphere, are they from the east to the west? And that's my questions.
Those are good questions. Yes, the Southern Hemisphere has jet streams, the same kinds that we have. They have a subtropical jet at about 25 to 35 degrees south, maybe sometimes a little closer to the equator. And they have a polar jet that's at a little higher latitude than our polar jet, as it turns out. And yet the winds in both of those jet streams are moving from west to east because the rotation of the Earth is the opposite as viewed from the South Pole. So the Coriolis parameter that affects the winds and directions of the winds has the opposite sign in the Southern Hemisphere. So everything ends up being west to east in both hemispheres.
I think the big difference, excuse me, in weather in the Southern Hemisphere and Northern Hemisphere is land mass.
Yeah, very
a lot of water.
Very
in
big
the
difference.
Hemisphere.
Yeah, and the jets are a little less wavy down there.
Oh, they are. Yeah,
they are. Yeah.
Because of that, landmass, less mountains?
That's my working hypothesis. Yeah. I suspect that that's the main reason, but it's not the only reason, probably. Mm.
And I was thinking about when I rode my bike on the Grabar, which was 300 miles or whatever on my bike, and And we started at the top of the state, and so we were going into the wind the whole way
to the
bottom of the state. I was thinking, next time I wouldn't mind going the other direction.
Yeah, except that's uphill then, right?
Yeah.
I don't know. Not sure which is worse.
Competing factors. That's a cost-loss analysis that needs to be done.
Ralph, thanks again. Dot in Manitowoc, it's your turn. Hi, Dot.
Hi. This may seem like a silly question, but I have melted snow, and I have watered my geraniums with that snow, and those leaves on my geraniums have really taken off. What is the nutrient value in snow? If that's a silly question, well, that is my question.
No, it's not a silly question.
No, we keep on hearing this. I forget what the answer was the last time we were thinking about this.
Well, it's the same as rain. When you get, people use rainwater because of the nutrients that are in the rain as it falls to the earth.
Through the atmosphere, yeah.
You know, there's nuclei, foreign objects, at the core of every raindrop and every snowflake, and they're not the same for the two types of precipitation. And I wonder if there's something about snow ice nuclei that's just a little bit better for plants.
Yeah.
It's not impossible. I just don't know what it is.
Right, yeah.
Well, maybe we've got a master gardener who can call it.
Right, yeah. I mean, I wonder what it is. Like aluminum and...
And naturally occurring, but they just don't do anything for, enhancing condensation, but they do for nucleation.
Right.
Yeah. I don't know what it is, though.
Dot, we're stymied stumped for the moment, but maybe we can come up...
But it's not silly.
No, it's not silly. Yeah. Maybe somebody will call in with an answer to that, or we can look it up and bring it up next time you're on.
Yeah.
For sure. Thank you, Dodd. You can join in, too, at 800-642-1234. Email to ideas@wpr.org. Wendy emailed to ask for those who are hoping to see the total solar eclipse in April. Is there, in 2024, I believe, is there a website, app, or organization she can go to and find out the odds of having a clear day? The eclipse will be going through Mexico, Texas, Arkansas, Southern Illinois, and then curving up through Indiana and Ohio. So we kind of miss it in Wisconsin.
Yeah, I'm sure there is. I mean, we know there are maps of probability of cloudiness that have been generated over a decade, ever since the satellites were up there. I'm not sure where I would imagine as we get closer and closer to the situation that people will start maps up.
Yeah. You know, for my money, I'd almost rather go to a place where I know it's going to be cloudy at midday to have it look like midnight, because the clouds will take away any of the corona.
That's
true. Really, really dark. That would be disconcerting beyond just seeing the disc in front of the sun for me, but everybody's different.
I've seen two total solar eclipses now, and in both cases, clear sky. And flat. One was in Montana and one was in Wyoming. And what is cool, that you wouldn't see in a cloudy condition, is the Terminator racing towards you.
Oh, that would be neat.
You could look at it because it's so flat. Yeah. You can see, there's a shadow, man. And you can see how fast the Earth is moving as that shadow approaches.
Yeah, that would be very cool. I changed my vote. I'd settle for second place in the cloudy day, but that's better. You're right.
When was it here? In Wisconsin,
Madison? Was it 17 or 18 or something? It wasn't that long ago.
It wasn't that long ago.
Might have even been 19.
Yeah,
I remember standing outside our building on a bright, clear...
Yeah, it was about 5 years ago.
Yeah, like 70, was it 80% or higher here or
it
something?
It was at like 80%. That's when we went to Wyoming.
I remember and that's the best I've ever seen, but it was pretty cool. But it wasn't as good as some of the things I heard about.
It's well worth it to go and do it if you ever get the opportunity.
Gary in the town of Ween has something for us. Hi, Gary.
Good morning, guys. Love your show as always. The question about snowfall being beneficial. Years ago, I used to be an egg person, and I spread limestone. And I spread lime. This was in early May. A guy was getting ready to seed his field down with alfalfa and use oats for cover crop. And it snowed 5 inches while I was spreading the lime. And he told me it was the best crop of alfalfa he ever had. And then he said the old timers, who compared to me now, they must be really old, always said, if you get snow on fresh seeding, it'll do better than anything.
Hmm. Ah.
Oh, okay. So now we've got like nitrogen fixing or something. There's something maybe about the ice nuclei that enhanced nitrogen fixing.
Or with
maybe.
This, with a snowfall, it's going to sit there and slowly melt and then moisten the seed in the area around it, whereas rain could wash it away,
too. That's another point. You're right, because the ground's going to be melting the underside of the snow, and gradually a drip will
gradually wet it.
Yeah. Wow, perfect. And with no chance of evaporation.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah,
right.
There you go. Gary, thank you. Very appreciate that comment and that story. It was wonderful. Don in Danbury, your turn. Hi, Don.
Hello. I'd like to ask the question, how does snow ever become measured in inches, especially over a... well, what I mean is, this winter we had a combination of snow and rain. And because of that, the accumulation and the weight of it all has collapsed a lot of garage roofs and along with a few businesses up there.
Yeah.
So I'm curious, why could there be a combination of how many inches and how much total water is accumulated through the season so far in a snowfall rainfall combination?
Yeah, and I don't know if I completely understand the question, but let me see if I'm right. There is the official measurement is made when it's snowing. There's an official snow measurement, but there's always also an liquid equivalent measurement, so that we never lose track of how much liquid equivalent we're gaining throughout the year. It's all liquid, of course, in the summertime. But then in the wintertime, the liquid equivalent is carefully measured as well. Now, I don't know if during an individual event where it's alternating between snow and rain, that separate categories for the liquid equivalent of the snow that falls is separate from the liquid equivalent from what you already know is falling already as liquid. I don't know that that distinction is made. I think it's at the end of the day how much liquid equivalent has occurred that day. And if you're got a mix on that day, you're going to try your best to measure the snow pot, and the rest will be the rain. But it's I don't think they make a distinction about liquid equivalent for that for the snow pot.
Yeah. Hmm. There we go, Don. Appreciate it. Jeff in Superior, your turn. Hi, Jeff.
Yes, gentlemen, I got to tell you, I'm so excited. I was driving from Hayward to Solon Springs last Wednesday night, all of a sudden in the pitch darkness, it was like this shooting green light went up in the north, and the northern lights just, it was like a sudden kind of explosion of light. I stopped the truck, I got out and I took some pictures, but there's some fascinating pictures on Instagram that people got over Lake Superior. It was really something I think we'll think about for a long time.
Yeah, it was a great display. I did not see it, and so I have three words that I've been telling my colleagues, courtesy of one of my other colleagues. I'm happy you saw it, I'm jealous you saw it, and I'm angry you didn't tell me about it. So
I was in a plane to D.C., so I totally missed that. But we have a rule in my family that if you see the Northern Lights, you must tell people.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
I mean, it's just so rare down here that it's just a rule. And if you don't, and unfortunately, I didn't see it. Wasn't online when some people were posting it, and Ann missed it. So,
and we were out an hour earlier than it started. And I noted, both of us, my wife and I, we noted how clear the sky was. It was a crescent moon and Venus above it. And I thought, what a beautiful night, and got better. But I didn't see it.
And that waking people up, I was on a fishing trip with there were 10 of us, I think. And I, at 1 in the morning, I realized I hadn't put a battery charger on my boat, so I go down to the lake and I look up and here's this Northern Lights, and so I run up and get the, I thought, yeah, you better do that.
I'm glad you did.
This is how the rule came in my family, because we were camping and somebody saw it and they stayed up to 3 in the morning and they didn't wake anybody.
Oh my God.
And we were all just really furious.
That's not right.
That became the rule. Yeah, I don't care what time it is. You wake people up.
Yeah, so I'm happy you saw it and I'm jealous you saw it, but I'm not angry. You couldn't have called me, but my friends could have.
Ned in Menominee emailed to ask, why in December, when the days get longer, does it get colder for the next month or two? And in June or whatever, when the days get shorter, it gets hotter for the next month or two.
Mm-hmm. That's a good question. That's because of water on the planet. Huge reservoirs of liquid water on our planet. And when the sun gets its minimum amount of incoming radiation, which is right at the solstice in the wintertime, it takes a while for the water to cool down around the hemisphere, and that kind of gives a lag for the temperature reaching its minimum till the end of January. And then it's just the opposite, but for the same reason in the summertime when the maximum radiation comes in around the 21st of June, the water keeps heating up for a while, and until it starts to cool down, you're not going to reach your maximum temperature, and that's usually 6 or 7 weeks later than that. So water is the big lag factor.
Well, here's a question I'm sure you guys can answer right off the top of your head. Mick emailed and wondered if there are any big unsolved questions remaining in meteorology, and if so, what are they?
Yeah, there's thousands of them. I mean,
I think there's thousands of them, and I think a good idea is, just an example, is why we forecasted 4 inches in Madison and we got 12?
Right.
So there's...
Excellent question. Yeah. And you can't figure it out until you do a really careful diagnosis. But there are so many thousands of such questions. One of the things about the day-to-day weather that's so interesting is that it never catches you exactly the way you expect it. So there's always something you can ask about it. But another question, why is the vertical motion intensity related so directly to the sea level pressure, but there's no particular physical or mathematical relationship that describes it? I'd like to know that.
Yeah.
So there's a couple right off the top. Justin emailed and said that older farmers he knew always said that snow in the spring was a poor man's nitrogen.
Okay. So, again, this is another question that comes up,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, must be some chemistry.
That means you're fertilizing. So, again, maybe it's the nucleation of the snow that brings that nitrogen out into the atmosphere.
Yeah.
Or maybe the gas, nitrogen gas.
I don't know. I mean, there's got to be something to it. Yeah, there's got to be something to it.
When a lot of people observe the same thing and have sayings that are consistent, means that something's going on.
But it could be totally wrong. It could be just that it acts, well for the early plant. And that's what you usually get when you use a lot of nitrogen. So it could be the totally unchemical reason. But nonetheless, it's interesting that there's something there.
It could be the soft melting.
Right. Yeah, the slow
to
hydration.
Heavy rain that runs off. Yeah.
Here's another one. A visitor at Olympic National Park photographed some hair ice. It looks like, white pieces of hair. And we have a photo of it on our show page. What's hair ice and how's it formed?
Hair ice is a weird thing. I've never seen it. And it's rare to see because it's associated with a particular tree. I think I want to say aspen, but that might be wrong. When it's rotting and deteriorating, there are fungi in there that are acting to decompose the tree, and that fungi gives off spores, and those spores, as I understand it, can act like nuclei.
Wow.
And so when they leave the tree, because they're emitting the spores to actually make more fungi, they nucleate and they cause the frost to form, then as it continues throughout the day, kind of pushes that frost up to form a group of hair type of things.
Wow, that's really, very cool.
It's really, really odd. It's not the frost that we're familiar with, which we're usually yelling at as we scrape it off our windshield.
Right.
Yeah.
That's neat. I've never heard of that.
Well, we have a photo of it up on our page, so if you go to ideas@wpr.org/Larry and go to today's date, you're going to see a nice photo of hair ice.
Yeah, and you'll take a second look. I know.
You'll
it's probably a similar photo that I've seen.
Yeah,
you look at it and go,
what I've never seen
that?
A picture of it. I'm going to look today.
Well, go to our page, and you're going to find it. So we've had many more comments and questions about snow mass and the variability of it. I think we've done a fairly good job of answering that question. And what's the weather going to be like for Wisconsin in the next month?
I can tell you John wants more snow because he wants to break the March record.
I want to break the record. We only have through Friday to do it. But we only need a tenth of an inch. I mean, that's not that much. It should not inconvenience anyone.
No, that's true.
Everyone should be
we
on
don't
my
even
team
shovel
on this.
A tenth of an inch.
Yeah, you don't even shovel. You let the sun do it.
If you do, you use a broom.
Yeah. And if you do that, you still need your head examined. Let the sun do it. Because we're moving to a time of the year where our first 90 temperature of the year is early April. Might not be this year, but that's when it starts to climatologically rear its head. So we're probably looking at a decent big change. This month here has been chilly. I can't believe we have a normal April. It's going to feel like summer.
Yeah.
Oh, John, Steve, thank you. We'll look forward to your next visit. John Martin and Steve Ackerman, our weather guys, with us, and they'll be back the last Monday of April. Tomorrow on the show, we'll talk about allergies with cats and dogs and how you might be able to treat your pet. That's tomorrow on the Ideas Network. In the meantime, stay with us. Lots in store. I'm Larry Mueller.